Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello and welcome to This is Critical. I'm Virginia Heffernan. This is Critical is the show where we question all of our assumptions about culture, like that life gets its meaning when we work hard, when really it gets its meaning when we sit in a chair, look at a bowl of cereal, and go, duh. But evidently, not everyone has come around to this obviously correct sloth-forward way of thinking. In the first episode of Hulu's series, The Dropout, a young Elizabeth Holmes, you know her as the founder of the disgraced company Theranos, is running laps at school, and she's been at it for a while. All the other kids have finished, and they're standing at the side, just waiting for her to finish already. But Elizabeth, barely shuffling, refuses to quit.
You can stop if you want to stop.
Hey. We'll cross the track till the last runner's done, all right?
It's a compelling and disturbing scene. Disturbing because it's not quite inspirational. It's sort of the inverse of the usual little engine that could stuff, in the sense that you almost want to beg little Elizabeth to stop, to just remind her to rest, to tell her that this particular aspirational finish line is just a fiction used to force kids who don't like to run into a combo of self-loathing and overachievement. The scene also gives a glimpse of the education of a mogul. Elizabeth is relentless, even when her goal is arbitrary, grueling, and meaningless. She's a finisher for the sake of finishing, a woman with boss babe motivational slogans where her moral sense should be. Now, this scene, a piece of fiction, of drama, also yields insight into Holmes and perhaps even compassion for her that, in my experience, had not been stirred by all the journalism, podcasts, and documentaries about Theranos. This scene is the kind of thing the Dropout's showrunner and my guest, Elizabeth Merriweather, does so well. Until recently, Liz was best known as the creator of New Girl and other network sitcoms. But a few years ago, Searchlight Television approached her about making another kind of show, an adaptation of The Dropout, ABC's podcast about Elizabeth Holmes. Now, you all know Holmes founded the blood testing company Theranos, which spectacularly collapsed after whistleblowers, skeptics, and a reporter named John Carreyrou exposed Holmes's many lies. And the lies were really something. I mean, the most damning was the claim that Theranos devices worked when they didn't. And then there were the kind of hilariously small random lies, like when Holmes told everyone her Siberian husky, who had a habit of soiling the office, was actually a wolf. He wasn't. The facts have been covered, but Liz Merriweather felt there was something big missing. Why? Why had Holmes done this? Who was she? What kind of person does this? The result is The Dropout, now streaming on Hulu and starring Amanda Seyfried. Yes, apparently that's the right pronunciation. The show is fantastic, just great television. I've watched it more than once, and it's also the most convincing take I've seen on Holmes and the culture that created her. Liz, thank you so much for joining me on This is Critical. I'm a huge fan.
Thanks for having me. I'm also a fan.
So I've been reeling for weeks since I finished watching The Dropout. And I gotta say, I've got a friend who was a roommate of Elizabeth Holmes at Stanford. And she said you guys got her completely right.
It's like, I don't even want to think about it. You know, for me, she just became the character in the series after a certain point. And that's kind of what she is in my head still. And it is a dramatization. Obviously, I did a ton of research and we were trying to like figure out a lot of what had actually happened. But in order to write it, I had to kind of get some distance from it and sort of think about her as a character.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can see that. I think we should back up for listeners who didn't follow in fine, granular detail the story of Elizabeth Holmes and give the broad strokes.
Elizabeth Holmes dropped out of Stanford beginning of her sophomore year and started this company, Theranos, that purported to be able to test blood using only a drop in a portable device. And she got an enormous amount of funding because she had support from Channing Robertson, who was a professor at Stanford. And the company lasted 12 years and it seemed to sort of dig itself deeper and deeper into this hole of kind of like trying to get funding while not really being able to ever deliver the technology it promised. It's to the point where they convinced Walgreens to put the machine in its stores and actually test real people. And they gave hundreds of inaccurate test results to people and also lost millions and millions of dollars. And then she was convicted of fraud, and now she's going to be sentenced in September. And she did it all with a man named Sonny Balwani, who she met when she was 18 years old and secretly dated for the entire time that Theranos was around. He joined the company at a certain point, and it's just a crazy, very complicated story with a ton of characters that come in and out and just so much scope. And I think like I had read a Vanity Fair piece by Nick Bilton, and I was immediately intrigued by the story and mostly her and her character and what led her to make these choices and why this all had happened. And then kind of put it away in my head. And then a couple years after that, I was approached by Searchlight, who had, and this was their first TV project, and they had gotten the rights for a podcast by Rebecca Jarvis, who's an ABC news correspondent. And she had put together this incredible podcast that I think delved really deeply into who Elizabeth was as a person and what was motivating her, and had some really amazing anecdotes that felt really cinematic to me. And Kate McKinnon was attached, and it was set up at Hulu, and they needed a writer, and they asked me to come in and pitch. And I had previously only done network comedy. When I say only, I don't know. I guess only is the wrong word, but
I mean, that's the hardest one. That's the like running the gauntlet.
But I created New Girl, which had run for 7 seasons, and I had 2 shows running, Bless This Mess and Single Parents, and it was just all in a defined category of network sitcom. And they reached out to me and asked me to pitch, and I was sort of surprised, and I was excited because I loved the podcast and I loved the story. But I also kind of felt like, what is the point of this? There's so much reporting. At that point, there'd been John Carreyrou's book, Bad Blood, and the documentary, The Inventor, and HBO, and a ton of articles and reporting. And I felt like people had kind of like learned about the story. And I didn't know if people were still interested. But the more that I talked about it, the more that I sort of thought about the project, I felt like her point of view had been missing from the story. I felt like the story from like a human emotional level hadn't been told. And that was the great mystery of the story for me, was just, who is this person and why did she make the choices she made? And journalists can't do that. It's kind of only writers. I mean, only like, you know, dramatists and screenwriters and that can fictionalize like that. And so I did actually feel like there was something additive about doing a limited series.
I wrote something about her, I reviewed Bad Blood, the John Carreyrou book that you and I both admire.
Yeah.
And in it, the closest I could get to a feel for Elizabeth Holmes was that, you know, every description of her said she had a low voice. The voice might be somewhat dubious, like maybe she had deliberately deepened it, and that she had mesmerizing blue eyes that seduced every man into giving up a ton of money. And so, in other words, she was looked at very much from the outside and just beheld by men who then gave her money. And that just didn't feel like...
It didn't feel like the full story. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, the reporting obviously is amazing, but it's very much told from the point of view of the whistleblowers or like the people who saw through her and not really at all from her point of view, obviously. And so I felt like there was room there for me. I felt like I could tell a story there that wouldn't feel just kind of like a gratuitous rehashing of what had happened. That actually felt like something that needed to be kind of explored for me. It was her main point of view as a young woman in this position of power that she, you know, didn't earn.
Yeah. So the other fact that there was a kind of void at the center of the company where the product, the one-liner that we learned about that, you know, you could test one drop of blood and you could find all different blood issues just from this one pinprick. The fact that that didn't work and never worked makes it a really kind of simple story. Like that's bold. And then there are the levels of secrecy. Okay. Stay with me here, Liz, but this whole scheme of Elizabeth Holmes makes me think of this project on the Bobcat that I had to do in fifth grade. And it had to have music. Like you had to write a song, you had to make a stuffed animal, you had to write a report, you had to give like a presentation, and you really had to like become your animal. It was whatever. Mine was a bobcat. So I wrote the paper pretty early on. You were supposed to take the whole year on it, but I'm not very good at crafts. So I just forgot about the rest of it. And then the night before, someone was like, "How's your animal project? It's due tomorrow." And I just went, "Oh no, oh no." It was supposed to be worked on all year. Ah! And I just went, "Oh my God." And, you know, I made my mom sew the thing and whatever. But it was just this crazy night of like secrecy and the zero that was at the center of my project. And I would never be able to get over. And I just kept thinking, what if you just had nothing in your pocket and you'd been bluffing so hard? And what would that feel like?
It's a very universal feeling. I think that's what's also like really interesting about this, because I've often said like that I relate it to her at some level, but like, you know, it's a tricky thing to say because, you know, I, as far as I know, I've not been convicted of fraud, but like the idea that I feel like everyone has kind of, you know, bitten off more than they can chew at one point in their life, or like over promised and sort of then, I don't know, like the up all night, the all nighter sort of frantic throwing together of something. I so connected to that, and I felt like a lot of New Girl was written in the middle of the night. You know, just like that sort of like, oh, we have to like shoot this tomorrow kind of feeling. And so I connected with her, and that really inspired. There's a sequence in the second episode where they're up all night in this hotel in Switzerland, which is based on an anecdote from Bad Blood, but it was like them all trying to get this machine to work for a demo the next day.
And yes.
And she, it said that she'd pricked her finger so many times that she couldn't feel her fingertip anymore. Oof. And it like this just primal thing where it's her own blood, you know, or she's actually just like pricking her finger and extracting her own blood, trying to make this thing work, and it's not working. I guess from purely a like metaphor place, I found the story was so rich with just images, you know, like this like blood and this machine that she's constructed to to understand herself and to understand people, and that yes. it never quite works. And that, you know, I just said there's so many parallels for me between the machine and her as a person, which is
that's
constantly
amazing.
Kind of like, yeah.
Yes. And the right. And that she wants it to look a certain way. Like it has right. to be a certain size. I mean, you're, yeah. you're like quite aware in this of how much PR Holmes was expected to do, that by the end, there's like a makeup and hair crew following her around at all times so that she can be ready to appear somewhere and then ideally convince investors in a roundabout way by doing all these articles and all these appearances that...
And her appearance became so much a part of her identity. You know,
yes.
it was sort of like there, the same thing happened to her that happened to the machine, where it was just... this facade with nothing behind it. And so, I mean, she embraced, you know, famously embraced the Steve Jobs uniform, where she would wear this black turtleneck and then she would wear like really bright red lipstick and put her hair back in a messy bun. And it was just, it was all kind of a sales tool. You know, it's like she made her identity into a sales tool in this kind of fascinating way in my mind, because it was so much coming out of, I think, fear or just like an inability to, she like never could be herself. I think she was always, at least the character in the show is kind of always like searching for some kind of self that I don't think she ever like reaches or finds.
We need stories like the Elizabeth Holmes parable to help us make sense of why these disasters happen. And sometimes the best way to do that is with fiction, to really get a feel for what makes people like Holmes tick. But how do you write a story inspired by real people when getting it wrong could mean, well, getting sued? That's coming up when we return.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
I have a charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera.
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
We're back with our guest, Elizabeth Merriweather, the showrunner of the Hulu series, The Dropout. One thing that Theranos seems to have done is, it was, we know it's a non-solution, but I think it's a non-solution to a non-problem. Like, we sort of lose track of, you know what, getting your blood drawn the normal way just isn't that bad. Right, exactly. Exactly. So like, yeah, so as just a, yeah, just a project, she does do a nice job making it sound like some miracle. I mean, her claim that it was used or could be used on the battlefield, you know, it took people a long time to figure out, why would you be testing someone's blood if they've been like shot by a, you know, blown up by an IED?
Well, I think people with like chronic illness, people with like long-term illnesses, especially cancer, I think cancer features really prominently in the series, but that would be miraculous. Like for people who have to constantly get their blood drawn, but she is sort of presenting it as if it's the answer to all of America's kind of healthcare problems, which it's like, it's, yeah, it when you step back, it's kind of like, okay, like, I mean, it would be good. It'd be nice, but it's not, you know, it's not going to, you know, change
right.
everything forever. But that was, I mean, I think that was the way that a lot of the CEOs, the tech company CEOs at that time, and potentially still now, were like presenting what they were doing. It couldn't just be a useful invention. It had to have sort of spiritual trappings, and it had to seem like it was like something bigger than it was. I, again, had no background in business, and I don't know that many entrepreneurs in my life. And so I listened to the NPR podcast, How I Built This, when I was preparing to work on the show, because it's a great podcast. But what Elizabeth Holmes did, obviously, she's been convicted of fraud, but up to a certain point, there are a lot of similarities with a lot of these stories where she was kind of like trying to, I guess, fake it till you make it. And, like that whole idea of just kind of trying to get investors and saying whatever you need to do to get investors. It's not, uncommon.
Yeah. I mean, I worked in tech for a while, and they called this move Wizard of Ozing sometimes. Entrepreneurs, I guess, do it all the time. They start off pretending that their product works, and then they just kind of figure it out once the money comes in.
But what she was doing was healthcare. I think that's what was like. She was like taking all of that sort of tech founder mythology and applying it to healthcare. And the stakes were so high, obviously, because it's people's health. And the kind of person who doesn't understand that, who doesn't mm-hmm. understand the difference between a computer and a human body, is the kind of person that I'm interested in exploring.
Yes, that absolutely. I mean, so just to get back to her character a little bit, she doesn't seem like a fraud from the beginning in your series. You have that image of her just unwilling to give up. Like somehow she just overrides any kind of intuition or even like bodily needs.
That's that anecdote from the podcast, and that's where the show starts, is that when she was 11 years old, she was running on this track and every other runner had finished the race and she was so far behind. Like the other runners couldn't cross the track and get water until the last runner finished, and she kept running. And Rebecca Jarvis, it's the last episode of the podcast, and she tells that anecdote. And I mean, that kind of drove everything home for me. A writer, you're just looking for like that one scene or the one anecdote that kind of sets everything up for this person. this is who she is. And I mean, there's something admirable about it. There's also something a little like sadistic about it. It's like she like these runners that were sort of hot and needed water, and like sort of maybe not sadistic, but just like there's an obliviousness, there's a destructive obliviousness, there's like a focusing so much on your own path, you're hurting other people. And so it felt like this amazing like distillation of the whole story for me.
It's so beautifully done, and also kind of rhymes with other ways that her movements are strange. The dancing is, I mean, obviously the dancing. Let's just have a moment about the dancing.
There was an anecdote in the podcast that I love where she talks about seeing Elizabeth in the parking lot early in the morning at Theranos when Elizabeth didn't think anyone could see her. And she was dancing in her car to hip hop music. And I just held on to that because there's so few anecdotes about who she was in private, or, who she was when no one was looking. And so that kind of just became this theme for me of what is her emotional outlet? Like, I don't think she's necessarily like, in broadcast news, like shutting the door and sobbing,
Yes, yes.
It's like, she's not that character. So I guess dancing became that for me, where I was like, okay, like this is how she gets some of it off, like the pressure, the emotion, this is how it comes out of her. And had a long conversation with Michael Schulter, the director, and Amanda Seyfried about, who's, obviously unbelievably amazing in the role, but just about what the dancing was, like I didn't want it to ever be, cute or sexy, or I wanted it to be her, this strange person trying to let emotion leave her body.
So we
worked on that, because it, Amanda is like a good dancer, so we were like trying to make sure that it always felt kind of raw and strange.
Yeah, And hype music. I mean, another, right. She's clearly using it to be like, you can do this, you know, and this like really kind of masculinist style of music that right. is devoted to, you know, maybe the kind of thing that if you were, you know, 80 laps behind everyone else on the team, you would sing something like that to yourself to get yourself to keep going and repress your shame. And it just comes across so, it's just done so well. I mean, I love that knowing that that was a note of yours. So two things that are a little bit, I don't know, that like are concerning to me. One is we have so many post-pandemic shows that are all so wonderful, including We Crashed and this one, that are based on real people and yet fictionalized. And I don't even know how did, in a world that's filled with NDAs, how did everyone get to use the names and clearly be, like write docu-fiction with, you know, Elizabeth Holmes and Adam Newman. I mean, some of it has to be made up. The quotes, the, you know, all kinds of stuff. We don't know if she really did sit alone, dance in that particular way when she was alone. We don't know anything about what she did when she was alone.
Yeah.
What's the, yeah, what, how does this work legally?
What's the process?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly, it was a huge part of the show. I mean, just like my conversations with lawyers, it was as soon as we started putting out story areas and outlines, I was having, you know, long, long conversations with lawyers the whole way through. But I mean, it's been vetted and I had to learn all of the sort of rules and laws around docu-fiction while it was happening, because I've never done anything like this before. You know, beyond the lawyers and all of the legal issues, I also personally felt this huge responsibility to kind of tell the story in a way that felt responsible, mm-hmm. that felt like, you know, I was aware that these were real people the whole time, mm-hmm. and most of them are alive. And I grappled with, you know, what is the point of this? And it's not to kind of like hurt people, but to try to better understand the story that ended up affecting a lot of people's lives, and try to kind of think of what were the factors that went into it that could possibly be changed in the future. Like what can we all be more aware of in the future if something like this happens?
We're going to take another short break. When we come back, there's another incredible character in The Dropout, one you probably haven't heard much about, but she could easily have been the star of the show. That's up next.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen, remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
We're back with Elizabeth Merriweather, showrunner of the Hulu series, The Dropout. So, Liz, I have a favorite character in the series. She's the one I feel like she's kind of a paradigm for what a hero in these situations might look like. And that's Erica Chung, the whistleblower who helped bring down Theranos. I don't know. I think it was a beautiful performance.
Yes, I've talked a lot about my connection to Elizabeth Holmes, and I think obviously the mystery of who Elizabeth is the driving force of the series, but a real reason to make the show for me was to tell Erica's story. I mean, this is a part of the story that people don't know about. Mm-hmm. There are some really fascinating parallels between Elizabeth Holmes and Erica, but then also big differences. You know, Erica went to Berkeley, Elizabeth went to Stanford. They're both in sciences. They're both young women. They both were assaulted their freshman year of college. And Erica talks about in her TED Talk that experience, and says she almost dropped out. And then she, she decided to stay, and then Elizabeth drops out. So there's these strange parallels between them. But then Erica's, you know, a woman of color and who someone who grew up in a trailer, like, you know, is coming from no money. Mm-hmm. And she is the one who brings down this company. Like, yes. She is the one that has the courage to do what so many people, I think, thought about doing, but just decided not to over 12 years of the company's life.
Yeah. I mean, can you tell, just for listeners who don't know her part of her story that we're referring to, how she brought down the company?
Well, it was her first job out of college. Oh my gosh, you know.
Yeah.
was recruited at a job fair, you know, and found the Theranos booth, I guess. And, you know, but it was like a very exciting opportunity for her. And she talks about, you know, Elizabeth was a female CEO in mm-hmm. a very male dominated world. And she was just really excited to work for a woman. And then she just immediately, upon arriving at Theranos, sort of starts to see all these things that are wrong. And the big thing that really bothered her was that they were asking her to cherry pick data. So they were asking her to kind of, like, you know, present a picture of the Theranos devices as if they were working, and mm-hmm. and throw out what they called outliers, which was basically any data point that didn't do what they wanted it to do.
Yes.
So she was like, that's not science. I mean, yeah. I think what I think is amazing about Erica is just this, like, she just loves science. I mean, she is so committed to the scientific method where you just follow the facts until you get to the mm-hmm. truth. And Elizabeth is so much about presentation and sort of tap dancing around the facts. And
yeah.
Erica was just very much about the facts. And she sort of found a kindred spirit in Tyler Schultz. And the two of them started to see all of these things that were wrong with the company. And they tried to tell George Schultz, Tyler's grandfather, who was on the board, about it, and he ignored them. Mm-hmm. She left the job, and then they started talking to John Carreyrou, the Wall Street Journal reporter. His article came out, but while it was coming out, Erica also wrote a letter to the Center for Medicare. Yeah.
That's just a beautiful scene. There, just for listeners, the reason we're forgetting the name of it is that it is deliberately the most boring name. I think, as Erica says, you know, she falls asleep in the middle of even naming it.
I do always forget it. It's CMS, but the Center for Medicare Services.
Yeah, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And I'm just only know that because I just looked it up. And she has that great line.
It's just this fucking boring fucking federal fucking regulatory agency that can shut her ass down.
Yes, she signs her name to this letter to them and basically alerts them that there are things going wrong with the lab, and they have the power to shut down the lab, which was like her main focus. I think it's like not even to get the articles out in the Wall Street Journal, mm-hmm. but to just shut the lab down. And so she ends up doing that. And yeah, so she's incredible. And now she runs a nonprofit for ethics and entrepreneurship. So she's just fully, fully good person.
I mean, it is a really, I think I've even mentioned on this show before that I think we're going to see after these, in the wake of these scams and frauds, a new interest in, you know, dropping the libertarian bravado about, like, we don't need the government. And this comes up in We Crash too. There's even a very similar conversation that you need a boring fucking government regulatory fucking agency, and that if they get a call, they have to investigate. And it is good to remember that journalists don't do whistleblowing. They can do exposés, but they don't get in there and shut a company down. You know?
Yeah. And that was actually, that was interesting for me as a writer, because I, you know, I've always adored All the President's Men, you know, just like that idea yeah. that like the journalist comes in and kind of like brings everything down. And it was a lot of conversation and about whether or not we were going to have an eighth episode. And, you know, at the end of the seventh episode, Carrie Rue's article comes out. And I was kind of like, how can we narratively go past that? Like, his article is out. But then the more I looked into it, I was like, that article wasn't the thing that brought the company down. It was her letter. It was Erica's letter to this federal agency. And so I felt, and that sort of that was a big moment for me, because I was like, okay, like that's a narrative that we haven't seen a lot on television, probably because it's not, you know, super sexy to like write a letter.
But you made it sexy and interesting. And the relationship, well, at least the platonic relationship between Erica and Tyler Schultz is fantastic. Oh, and I should say for listeners, Tyler Schultz worked at Theranos too and eventually became a whistleblower. But he wasn't just another Theranos employee. Tyler is the grandson of former Secretary of State George Shultz, who was a major backer of Elizabeth Holmes. I mean, I could go on and on about how interesting that is and how it didn't occur to Tyler Schultz, even though he's obviously a good guy, to turn to the government. Because I feel like American dramas are always, it's always like a maverick, right? Who's saying, I'm not going to listen to the laws.
I'm not going to follow your rule. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And that is, you know, the even the journalist stories where the like shaggy, awesome, all the president's men, you know, are kind of like going off piste and doing all this like awesome, you know, kind of thinking for themselves. And just having this really extraordinarily captivating figure of Erica Chung do this thing with so much brio. I really was like, now we have a hero story about how this kind of gets done. And the guy from the regulatory agency who just like makes a sandwich and cannot be seduced by Elizabeth Holmes. My God, it's so good. It's so good. Let's hear it for government. All right. I have to ask one thing about... you know, as I said, I worked in tech. I worked in startups for a while, and we had people Wizard of Ozing and making products that didn't work, and faking it in the moment, and all kinds of other shenanigans. But now she's the poster girl for all of this. Is it because she is a woman? Do you think?
I mean, it's very complicated. And that's honestly what I love about the story, is that it's like there is sexism at play, and then there is her kind of using her sex as a form of manipulation as well. You know, I love that there isn't this like cut and dry part. You can't point to her and say, you know, she's a victim or she's not you know, like she's a lot of things. And that's what I love about the story, especially these days, because I just, you know, I think when it comes to a lot of these, you know, conversations about gender, people want there to be like a good and a bad, and, you know, like they want things to be black and white. And I think that she's a really complicated figure. It's interesting that she's, you know, has been convicted. At the same time, like I said, she was doing something in healthcare. It was health. The business part of the fraud, I think, is shared between a lot of these people. But like the sort of actually giving patients the wrong health results is different, you know?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that seems absolutely right to me. I mean, it's such a great, it's just such a great series. And for anyone who doubts, it's, you know, thoroughgoing commitment to a feminist eye or woman's eye. You know, you don't have to look any farther than Erica Chung.
I'm so glad that you noticed that, because I had one meeting with a designer who's a female designer, and she was like, why are you telling this story? Like, why should we be focusing on a woman in science who committed fraud when it's so hard for women in science, you know, normally? And it was a really tough question. And And the answer I got to was Erica Chung and Phyllis Gardner. And I think the story presents a lot of different sides to being a woman in science. And like, especially the sixth episode, which kind of like tells those three stories in parallel. But yeah, I mean, I thought that telling all of their stories, all of those women's stories, was really important, and to look at them side by side, you know.
I think it worked out beautifully, and it is just so compelling. I've watched several episodes, including six, multiple times, just to try to figure out how you did it, reverse engineer it, but I couldn't do it. Thank you so much, Liz, for being
here. Thank you. What a fun conversation. This was really fun. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's it for this week's episode of This is Critical. Make sure you don't miss next week's episode by following us or subscribing on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Pandora, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review our show on Apple Podcasts. Wow, it really helps other people to learn about the show. For more information and to keep tabs on us, follow me on Twitter at Paige88 and at ThisCriticalPod. If you have a question or a cultural creed you think deserves another look, send us an email at thisiscriticalpod@gmail.com. This is Critical is made by me, Virginia Heffernan, and Stitcher. Corinne Wallace, Michelle O'Brien, and Ella Fetter are the producers. Tracy Samuelson is our editor. Brendan Burns mixed this episode and composed our original theme. And Josephine Martirana is our executive producer. Thanks for listening and stay critical.
Stitcher.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
I had a charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink?
This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera.
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.